two fatal police-involved shootings in the city of Jacksonville this week. Meanwhile, activists want assurance that Amendment 4, restoring voting rights to ex-felons, is actually implemented. And the changing face of Jacksonville now on pace to become a minority-majority city. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and just ahead, a very busy news week. We're talking about it all with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Join the conversation. Then later in the hour, it's a special treat. We've got a live performance from members of the world-renowned Soweto Gospel Choir. They'll be along later in the hour. You won't want to miss that. Keep listening. But first this morning, it's Friday. It's a rainy Friday morning. I hope everyone is staying dry out there. We are certainly dry and ready to go here in studio as we discuss a busy news week. Welcoming to the show, Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics is here.
Thanks for having me.
Radio host Angela Spears of Angela Spears Communications.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. And new to the roundtable, we're pleased to welcome Tanika Hughes, anchor at Action News Jax. Hey, Tanika.
Hi, good morning.
Good to have you on the show, and lots to discuss this week. Everything from what we can expect from Governor-elect Ron DeSantis as he plans out his new administration, to a look at the changing demographics of Jacksonville and more. All of that coming up. But our top story this Friday, there have been two fatal police-involved shootings in Jacksonville in less than 24 hours, both on Wednesday. Now, one of these incidents happened in Mandarin as police fatally shot a robbery suspect. Earlier on Wednesday, police fatally shot another man after they say he fired a handgun at two officers on the north side. Here is Assistant Chief Scott Dingy of the JSO.
The suspect also has a documented history of mental illness issues. Near the suspect's body, officers located a very realistic-looking replica of a revolver. Closer inspection revealed the weapon to actually be a .177 caliber BB gun.
Okay, so what officers thought was a handgun turned out instead to be a BB gun. Assistant Chief Dingy saying these two incidents in less than a day show how dangerous police work is in Jacksonville, Florida. At the same time, activists are once again calling out JSO, the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, saying the police get failing marks in the areas of trust, transparency, and accountability. Neither of these incidents was recorded on a body camera, although police in the city are rolling that program out. So we begin the hour with a closer look at these police-involved shootings. What are your questions and thoughts? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. You can also weigh in, of course, on our Facebook page. All right, Dan Scanlon, you covered this for the Florida Times Union. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about these two incidents, what we know so far.
Well, first of all, don't forget that there was in between at 6:40 p.m., there was a joint JSO-FBI investigation going on near Kings Road, and an FBI agent was shooting at someone who was shooting at them. So there were three law enforcement-involved shootings within 11 hours that day. The first one was Dunn Avenue Motel 6, right there at the exit. A person who apparently told family members and girlfriend he wasn't going back to prison and he was going to shoot a cop, and then came out after sending his girlfriend out when the cops found the stolen car that apparently he had carjacked earlier in Macon. So he leveled the gun. He fired the first shot, according to Chief Dingy, and then the officer fired 15 shots back. Some eyewitnesses at the scene telling us there that the officers kicked him when he was down. Dingy responding to state that he doesn't know, but police procedure is to, in any way or form possible, determine A, if the suspect is alive or dead, and B, get the weapon away from them. So you've seen it in movies. Maybe they kicked the suspect to find out status of health, kicked the gun out of the way and misconstrued. That maybe we'll find out. The second one happens at 9 o'clock at night. There is an armed robbery occurring at a Mandarin apartment complex. A food delivery person is robbed. Then the suspect gives the money back and says, that's not what I'm into. And then half an hour later, with the bolo out to be on the lookout for this person, an officer finds him in another apartment complex, and the person pulls up a gun. As he's turning, the cop fires two shots, does not know if he's hit the suspect. Suspect found later dead in a breezeway with a bullet wound to the chest. And again, cops finding out the gun is a .177 caliber, very realistic looking BB gun. And I'm looking at a photo right now. If that were waved at me, I'd be a little freaked out too. I'm not going to look and see what it is. So that's what happened, Dingy, discussing both at a 3:30 news conference yesterday.
Okay, and Tanika Hughes, this is something that we've seen many times before in the city of Jacksonville, where there is a police-involved shooting, police chasing a suspect. The suspect ends up being fatally shot. And as we wait for the facts to come out about these two incidents, both happening on the same day this week, we need to point out that, as Dan said, we don't have all the facts. At the same time, there is not video of either of these shootings, and JSO, like so many other police agencies around the country, is rolling out a body camera program for officers because activists have complained that there's a lack of accountability for police in these types of incidents.
Yeah, and let me touch on that from two points. Let's talk about what we know about the cameras that are there. So we know that JSO rolled out the body camera program earlier last month. They actually announced it about 24 hours after another police-involved shooting. From our reporting, we understand that 77 were given to officers, but in Zone 1, which is the downtown area, not where these two recent shootings happened. And we also understand that JSO intends to train about 200 officers per quarter and eventually roll the program out over the course of about 2 years.
Yeah.
Our law and safety expert believes that they may need to reevaluate the distribution process, and maybe those officers in some of the higher crime areas need to carry them. As far as what activists are saying about the transparency in all of this, as you mentioned, Ben Frazier talked about a proposal from Bethune-Cookman University talking about community involvement in the transparency process. We know that JSO has put out some information on its body camera policy, but it includes information about activation and deactivation, how that data will be stored, who has access to it, who can review it. There's really not, from what I've seen, a community component involved in what we've seen so far.
Right. The Northside Coalition is pressing police to roll out a more transparent community engagement plan because these incidents have become such a flashpoint, not only in Jacksonville, but let's face it, just about every major city in the country. AG Angela Spears, how do you assess police response to the activists' complaints and the points that they are bringing up?
I think it's important. People I've been talking with and hearing from is that they want to be involved, and it's about educating the community. I was just talking with someone yesterday about this process of educating the community if they could see the facts, right? We don't know all the facts, but if they can be a part of, obviously you can't be privy to every single thing when it comes to a police investigation, but if you have a citizens review board of some sort where the community is sitting in so they could see, okay, what is it like when an officer goes up to a scene. Dan and I were just talking about this. He was talking with us beforehand that, you know what, he went into something where it's an active shooter, or he was trying to shoot to see each time if he would be able to shoot someone or not shoot. And he said he got shot each and every time. So it's like educating. I think it's important to educate the community so that they are aware of what happens when a police officer is in a situation and there's nothing wrong. We say there's nothing wrong with it, but we have to get that implemented, I think, more and more, AG, to get that involved so that people have, they can see, they know the flip side of what police officers are going through and what it's like for them.
Let's talk about the politics of the situation. You know, first of all, the Northside Coalition, they show up at city council, they give a lot of public comment, et cetera. But we got a 2019 election, and the one person running against Sheriff Mike Williams who could change the thing is Tony Cummings. He ran before, he got about 4%. He's got about $1,000 in the bank. Running against Mike Williams, he's got $400,000 to deploy and, you know, more to raise as he needs it. So, you know, I don't see any change happening at the ballot box. The police union is the most powerful union in the city. They negotiated the terms of this body camera contract. They had to protect their position. The sheriff's office had to protect its. The city had to protect its. It was a complex process. There's a limited amount of money in the budget, you know, for these cameras. And it's ironic, the same activists that want more money for the body cameras are the ones saying they should have cut JSO's budget last summer. So which is it? I mean, do you want the budget cut or do you want more money for cameras or what? And, you know, the time to address that would have been August during the budget hearings in, you know, city council. I mean, because that's when the budget for next year is formulated.
And the sheriff's office did hold public meetings prior to this and posted them, very vocally posted them. So those could have been a place for it. Chief Dingy did talk about this briefly yesterday. He did indicate that there is a rollout procedure and it does take training. And again, if they're in downtown only, realize Monday morning shooting was way on the north side. Wednesday night shooting was way into Mandarin, which Mandarin still is not seen as a place where you would need maybe body cameras. Most Joe Sixpacks would not think that.
Why North, is that?
I don't know. Maybe because
Why
my first impression,
think that, Dan?
My first impression when I covered Mandarin for the newspaper 20 years ago was there's need for a facility that helps needy people and a food bank. I couldn't believe Mandarin suburb needed that.
But see, that's the thing. We live in a community now where there is poverty everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There is violence
including
everywhere.
Mandarin.
Including Mandarin, including the beaches, including St. John's County. I think we need to be really upfront about the fact that this is not just an urban core problem, that this is a countywide, community-wide issue, whether it's gun violence and also the poverty in this community.
But that's where the sheriff's office put its ShotSpotter system, in the urban core. That's where it's obviously still thinking, maybe 1990s thinking, but thinking that's where the body cameras need to go first. And I think Wednesday proved that there's crime and desperately nasty crime way elsewhere.
Let's go to your phone calls now. As we talk about the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, what are your thoughts? Give us a call, 549-2937. Richard is on the south side. Hi, Richard. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Melissa, thank you guys for having us. First of all, just let me say real quick, nothing against the guys, but this is the first time we've had, like, the three powerful ladies in media all behind the same mic, and I'm so glad I've had a chance to meet all of you and respect you quite well.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much.
All right. You've already said. By the way, I'm fall into that category of activists. I've been on the show. I work with Ben Frazier. I respect his work. I work with children. I believe you should get them early. I teach them music. I do all the things in my community. But it makes my blood boil because I can listen to the radio and listen to the media. The first time they put the photo of this young man that was killed tragically by the police officer, the very first words out of the mouth of the anchor was, he had mental problems. The next thing that happens is, when you're talking about the black community, I'm an activist. I don't know the last time I protested about anything angrily. I try to have civil conversation. I'm more of an advocate. If we can get rid of the word activist when talking about black people and mental illness when talking about white people, we will level the playing field in the media. That's the first thing. The second thing is, please do not say if these activists want this, we got to give up something. Number one, I'm not an activist, but most importantly, I'm a taxpayer. And I'm willing to pay more taxes to give police officers body cameras so that my son who's in college and come home on break doesn't have to fear being shot. And then finally, we just weaponized the police department because the Supreme Court passed the law that says a police officer can now use stand your ground as his personal defense because he can say he feared him. So imagine Trayvon Martin, or imagine even more if it wasn't Michael Dunn, but a police officer that shot Jordan Davis. Do you think the police officer would now be in jail because he said, I thought he had a gun and I feared for my life? We need to change our legislation. By the way, Duval County is blue now, and I believe voters are going to have a say very soon. So, but forgive me for the passion right now, but I just want to make certain that we can have a civil conversation and stop placing labels on our community.
All right, Richard. That's Richard on the south side. A lot to go over, a lot of points he made in that call, beginning with the fact that he mentioned police body cameras. By the way, Sheriff Mike Williams has said repeatedly that he is in favor of expanding the use of body cameras because he believes that they will benefit the police as well as the community. Now, Richard also mentioned that this county went blue in the midterm elections. But as you pointed out, AG, that may have been the case for the statewide candidates that were on the ballot. More about that in a moment as we talk about the incoming Ron DeSantis administration. But I don't think it changes the game so much for Mayor Lenny Curry's reelection, Sheriff Mike Williams' reelection, and other prominent local Republicans. And so there's a lot to discuss in that call.
Yeah, regarding the political thing, and I'll say this very quickly so we can get to the other points. Mike Williams, Melissa Nelson, Lenny Curry, they are yoked. They are linked. They have co-messaged about how they have a shared approach to crime fighting. And, Melissa Nelson's been on the record saying that that footage will be used, I guarantee it, in an ad for Lenny Curry and or Mike Williams coming up in the next few months. The fact that there is a symbiosis, we haven't seen that at all times in the city. Remember when Alvin Brown and John Rutherford were at war a few years ago? This is a different dynamic. They're going to back each other up, and it's going to be a big play because the Republicans have all the money and the momentum when it comes to these 2019 elections. The Democrats don't even have a real candidate running for mayor yet, and for sheriff, they've got somebody with no money.
NAG, do you see the sheriff staying around as sheriff to run again, or do you see his star rising because of his involvement in national and state politics?
A lot can happen in 4 years, but I mean, Williams string in 2019, 2023 is a different story because the mayor's office will be open and we don't know what everybody's ultimate ambition is. But I definitely see, the next, this 2019 election and 2020 Nelson election, they are devoted to that shared messaging.
And let's point out, too, that Sheriff Williams was closely aligned with Governor-elect Ron DeSantis. Mm-hmm. And in a moment, we'll talk about the new governor's transition planning. But first, let's take a few more calls on these police-involved shootings in the city of Jacksonville. 549-2937 to join our Friday media roundtable right now. Deborah is on the north side. Hi, Deborah. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Deborah.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to let you all know that there are body cameras on the north side. And I think a lot of times we concentrate on the suspects rather than the victim a lot of times. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's point out, Tanika Hughes, these body cameras are rolling out, perhaps not as comprehensively as activists would like, but they are out there on the streets now in some parts of the city.
Yeah. Our understanding is about 77 as of the last update we got from JSO last month, about 77 were rolled out. But again, what we were told was zone one, which is mostly the downtown area. Something to point out, though, we did have an officer involved shooting on Melson Avenue. And there was a field training officer involved last month, and that officer was wearing a body camera. Mm-hmm. Neighbors told us that the officer fired several shots. This all happened as a result of a traffic stop attempt. Neighbors told us they heard several shots. Police say there's no evidence that the suspect fired any shots. But in that case, there was a field training officer wearing a body camera. JSO says that video will be reviewed. So I think that that could give us some indication as to how future body camera related investigations will go. So we have had an example here.
And, we've had numerous national instances recently where body camera video has been revealed and shown how things went down. And in one case showed an officer shooting without any provocation as the suspect was running away. So I'll be intrigued to see if that body camera ever shows anywhere in the future something where a cop is not maybe correct in doing the shooting.
Stephanie is in Putnam County. Hey, Stephanie, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was just curious. I keep hearing that they had 200 body cameras bought, but they have to roll out training first. How much training could possibly be involved in putting on a body camera and turning it on?
Yeah, great question. let's talk about that.
Yeah,
the technology that these officers are going to be wearing.
This comes back to what can possibly go wrong, which is quite a bit. You look at it and you think, oh, point and click, but there's storing footage, there's archiving footage, there's the rights, so you get to review the footage, there's all those things. And
which
you have
is
to get
what the Northside Coalition is they're demanding access to this footage, which police don't want to just hand over.
Yeah, I mean, they might have to make a charter change for that. I mean, the police don't have to do something like a community review board. They don't have to do these things. Mm-hmm. And what is in their interest to do it? Because, police are working in a hierarchical organization. They want to keep their jobs. They want to protect what they're doing, their larger mission. So, why would you bring an activist to have expressed fundamental hostility to the mission of the JSO? I mean, that's really the thing. So, if people want a community review board, they have to approach it in a way that you know, goes beyond blaming JSO for what's happening, because there's a lot more going on than, you know, police who may or may not be acting outside their bounds.
And you know, the call of the first caller we had, and he made a good point of us, instead of us saying activists, to say taxpayers. And that's a very, very good point. I jotted that down. But it's important to get all sides. So I understand that, yes, you can't just have people who are railing against JSO, but you have people who are for. That's why you get a diverse community engagement board to look at things, to sit down with police officers and say, okay, yes, I understand why you did this, or no, I don't understand. Explain this to me. So it's a diverse audience, right, of who we need to get
and police,
in our community.
Police have been resisting calls for a civilian review board in this city for basically decades. So that is not a new demand.
And don't forget, JSO is unique among agencies, police agencies in the state, that it does its own investigation of in-house. If you go to any other county, Florida Department of Law Enforcement steps in immediately to handle and pulls the investigation away from that department. That department also then refuses to talk to us about anything. So
because
also,
it's in the hands of FDLE.
It's in the hands of FDLE, and that will take a number of months, and we don't have any of that here. Also, don't forget, an officer can choose to turn off or turn on that body camera, and that has been an issue where suddenly you find out that there's no video. Maybe the officer decided this was getting a little dicey and I don't want evidence. Click, off it goes. At least that's the way I saw it on a TV show once.
And if you're just tuning in, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 with our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest headlines from the week all around town. We're going to talk about a few other news and notes from the week now. And the number to join us, 549-2937. Give us a call. And we talked a minute ago about the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville. Well, they had a pretty busy news week themselves because they were out rallying earlier this week around Amendment 4. Now, that passed overwhelmingly at the ballot box this November, a ballot amendment that restores voting rights to ex-felons. However, it looks like there could be delays in its implementation. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis says he intends to wait to implement Amendment 4. Some legislators have said they have more questions about how to implement Amendment 4. Supervisors of elections around the state say they aren't getting any direction from the Secretary of State as to how to implement Amendment 4, which basically states that felons that have served their time for nonviolent crimes should have their voting rights automatically restored beginning on January 8th. And so when you talk about Amendment 4, it looks, critics say anyway, like an attempt to slow roll the will of the people who have passed this ballot amendment. And that certainly wouldn't be the first time in Florida that we saw the legislature attempt to maybe throw sand in the gears, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Florida sand from the beach. And try not to implement something that the voters clearly say they want. The medical marijuana amendment comes to mind, too.
It's like faking an injury at the end of a game. You know, that's what's happening here. The Republicans realize that this voter bloc will largely go Democrat, largely go independent. They're not going Republican if they've been in prison. And, you know, that's really the thing. So the implementation legislation is a way to stall it out so it doesn't really affect the 2019 municipal elections, Jacksonville and elsewhere. Maybe you can stall the 2020 to get Donald Trump over that hump one more time, who knows? But that's really what's happening. We saw it with Amendment 2 also, as you mentioned, Melissa. In Amendment 2, it got implemented, and there are still issues regarding smokable cannabis and things like that regarding the distribution model for cannabis. So, you know, this is going to be a work in progress.
Yeah. But again, this passed, by the way, let's point out, it takes 60% approval to get a ballot amendment passed in Florida. Tanika, that's a pretty high bar. And we saw widespread bipartisan support in this state for restoring voting rights to ex-felons. We have the highest percentage of disenfranchised ex-felons of any state in the country. So this really will significantly change our voter base if it's fully and thoroughly implemented.
Yeah, and this received 64.5%, so it definitely hit that threshold. And also, about 23% of African Americans, adults, can't vote right now because of previous felony convictions. So you talk about that voter base being diversified. Yeah, it will make an impact for sure.
Okay, and at the same time, we're seeing Governor Ron DeSantis not only say he wants to wait to implement Amendment 4, which certainly supporters of the amendment are criticizing. At the same time, Governor DeSantis has begun his transition planning. as Andrew Gillum, the man he defeated, came to Jacksonville this week to thank supporters Wednesday night at 1904 Music Club. What are your questions about the incoming DeSantis administration? Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, you know, Ron DeSantis is certainly a very strong conservative. At the same time, on certain issues, we're going to see a departure from how Rick Scott ran Tallahassee. In particular, the implementation, as you mentioned a minute ago, of Amendment 2, mm-hmm. the medical marijuana amendment. I don't think we'll see Ron DeSantis try so hard to delay that implementation the way we saw with former governor, now Senator Rick Scott. But what else can we expect from this administration?
You know, it's very interesting. I was talking with people on both sides of the aisle, and on the Republican side, well, both sides are saying they're not quite sure what to expect, because it goes back to, and Melissa, we talked about this here on your show, that he really didn't have a clear message, some would say, when he ran for governor. We didn't know why he was running. He didn't put it out. And others are saying they're expecting more of the same. I've heard some people saying they're expecting just more of coming down from Trump, from the White House, kind of implementing things that are going on in D.C. from Donald Trump, because he is Ron DeSantis, the governor-elect, is a big Donald Trump, President Donald Trump supporter, that we're going to see some of that in Florida. So some people just overall don't know what to expect.
Right. He says he'll move quickly on water quality issues for the state, huge issue for Florida. He wants to fill three Florida Supreme Court vacancies. And at the same time, he's calling for caution in implementing Amendment 4. So DeSantis takes office January 8th. At the same time, let me ask you all about Andrew Gillum. There was this ongoing FBI investigation into Tallahassee public officials. Certainly, most political observers think that played a role in Gillum going down to defeat, although he was leading in most polls up until election night. Now, there have been two indictments handed down this week over that FBI investigation in the state capitol. Neither involved Andrew Gillum. And so cynics are painting a narrative that perhaps the FBI dragged that investigation out to hurt Andrew Gillum's chances for governor. No proof of that, though. What are your thoughts?
Didn't Gillum say that Florida had 99 problems, but an FBI investigation wasn't one?
He said that.
Did he say, okay.
That didn't play with the voters, though. It didn't make the sale, but sure he did say that, yes.
You know, but this is the thing with the Gillum investigation. The question is going to be why the FBI waited until, you know, conveniently after the election to release this information. You know, but that said, Gillum didn't effectively counter messages. I mean, DeSantis was pounding him for a solid month, and that's where, you know, his negatives went up. That's where, you know, he lost those independent voters that eventually went to DeSantis. That's how it happened. But, you know, when you look at Andrew Gillum's future, you know, what does he do next? 2022 elections, he's got a long time to get stale before that. You know, 2020's been talking to Barack Obama, talking to Beto O'Rourke, you know, looking at that next national move, at least, you know, on a quiet level. So I'm looking for him to go to Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and see if crowds there like him, because, you know, Andrew Gillum is never going to get hotter than he is right now. Mm-hmm. But I think really he's more of a national figure right now than a state figure.
Can a guy that left office as a local mayor, lost a statewide race, can he mount a credible national campaign?
With enough money, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Gillum has been a fundraising machine since he got the primary nomination. I don't think that changes, because he and Beto O'Rourke are the two, like, hot names that can actually appeal to swing voters. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see them as a ticket in some capacity.
Well, Tanika. Yeah, and we also saw Stacey Abrams just this week talk about how she's fired up and she does plan to return to public office. She didn't release what capacity, but another name that
she
saw
ran for
momentum
governor in Georgia and lost. Yeah. Yeah. So it's really fascinating to see these regional players potentially ascend to the national stage in 2020, which is right around the corner. It doesn't feel
It'll be here before we know it, Melissa.
It'll be here before we know it.
You know, there was a young guy by the name of Barack Obama that nobody knew anything about, and he was a lawmaker in Washington, and he was sharp and he was smart. He didn't have gray hair at the time, and lo and behold, he became president. So anything is possible with Andrew Gillum, who is also a very sharp, smart, and well-spoken young man compared to me, who's 62. Sorry.
Here's a tweet from Jimmy about Amendment 4. He tweets the show. Amendment 4 is self-executing. There is no role for the new governor and legislature other than appropriate oversight. If rights aren't restored as directed on January 8th, then the system has failed and voter suppression in March and May will be a reality. Now, we do have a first election in Jacksonville in March, a runoff in May for mayor, for a host of other seats. So what about that? If we don't see Amendment 4 implemented robustly, is the vote being suppressed in our local elections?
You know, that would be the question. And if there's a stall out in registering people, there's going to be legal action against the city, against supervisor of elections. They're going to have to respond to this. And you see a lot of lawsuits across the state on this one. They definitely have an obligation, according to the language of the amendment, to implement it faithfully and to let people register. And these groups can bring people and bringing pressure on. But, you know, like I said, they're stalling out the clock.
What if it gets hung up during the March session over the implementation language gets hung up in parties and doesn't come out, and then the governor says, well, I'm sorry, the state legislature has got it stuck. Then even more lawsuits.
And if you're just tuning in, it's 549-2937 to join our Friday media roundtable. Now, as Tanika mentioned, Amendment 4, if implemented fully, will change this state's voter base significantly, as those who have served their time will be instantly eligible to vote after they complete their sentence. Currently, felons can't vote for the most part in Florida. We also want to make note of something else that caught our eye this week. Speaking of demographics, new census figures for Jacksonville show the city is changing rapidly. We are on pace to become a minority-majority city within a year or two. And the reason we want to talk about this is that you might not have realized that Jacksonville, Florida, and Columbus, Ohio are the largest American cities that are still majority white. But that is going to change, and soon, for a number of reasons. New immigrants moving to Duval County, and at the same time, more white residents moving out of Duval County as it becomes more diverse. Quite often, white families move because they want to put their children in, say, the school system in St. John's County or perhaps Nassau County. This is a complex demographic story, but it's one that's really playing out right before our eyes in Jacksonville. And people might not have realized that Jacksonville and Columbus were the only large cities left.
I didn't know that.
That were majority white.
I didn't know that. Melissa, when we, back in our old news days, television news days, you know, we always did stories, I don't know if you remember this, did stories about the Hispanic population growing here in our area. And so we always knew this was on track. And AG, you'll love this politically, the political landscape, of course, this is going to change too, our voting demographics. As we've mentioned before today, that Duval County is now blue. And I think it'll continue to go blue, even though, AG, you mentioned the Republicans have more money, they're doing things. The county is still going to go blue. And I think this is going to change those demographics when it comes to that. Yeah. And we're going to continue to see that.
Yeah, the demographics in November reflected this change as Andrew Gillum and other candidates running for statewide office won Duval County. The first time you've seen that happen in this county
It didn't happen osmotically, though. I mean, you know, Gillum had his turnout machine going before the primary. That's how Gillum got 50% in the primary, because he engaged his voters. He brought them back in November. I don't see an Andrew Gillum waiting in the wings for Duval Democrats in 2019. I don't really see an Andrew Gillum waiting in the wings for Duval Democrats in 2023. They've got to develop some talent. They've got to develop some people that can go toe-to-toe with Mayor Lenny Curry or whoever comes next.
And that is not, despite the good turnout operation that the Dems had in November this time, you're right. There's a dearth of local candidates that can really flip the script in this county.
I mean, the council Democrats, except for Garrett Dennis, go along with the mayor's office. And Garrett Dennis, you know, he's looking at supervisor of elections run right now against Mike Hogan. That's what the word is now. It's going to be interesting to see if the party actually gives him support or leaves him hanging out to dry like every other Democrat running who doesn't have an independent fundraising operation.
And it's interesting, Hogan got hung out to dry because he would not send out the Spanish language ballots in advance. And if you're having a larger number of minorities in a city, then that may influence the way they vote.
And for me, this is indicative of the way that Jacksonville, despite being a really big city, mm-hmm. is sort of lagging behind other major cities in terms of the changes you're seeing all over the country in demographically and how city officials are responding to those changes, whether it's providing Spanish language ballots for Hispanic voters, or a number of other things. But this is something that we'll continue to follow on this program. It's 549-2937 to join us. Now, we also want to make note of something that just came to us in the newsroom this morning. A revised complaint filed against the Duval County Public Schools and the Duval County School Board. This is a lawsuit against armed safety assistance in our Duval public schools. And the complainants, some parents, and also the League of Women Voters of Florida, their initial complaint was tossed out, but they have filed a revised complaint saying that they are suing, in their words, to protect tens of thousands of elementary school children from harm. They are concerned that inadequately trained individuals who are not law enforcement officers are going to be carrying guns while policing public schools. The lawsuit says that although they know that Duval is executing a well-intended effort to comply with a new state school safety law, they believe this program, these armed safety assistants in our schools, is based on an incorrect interpretation of the law. And we're just getting this revised complaint into our newsroom right now. And so certainly feelings are running high about armed safety assistance in our local schools. It's 549-2937 to join us. Dan Scanlon, this complaint was filed some weeks ago, was tossed out. It's been revised. It's active again.
And the thing that concerns us, and we've talked about this here at this forum before, is what happens when people who are not trained police officers, who do not have hundreds of hours of training in negotiation skills, how to identify a suspect, are given guns. We had an incident in Georgia 8 months ago, where a teacher had a gun that went off. Mm-hmm. We had an incident here in Jacksonville where one of these security guards pawned his weapon, not once, but twice. And then two other of those security officers also apparently were involved in this. All three got booted out. But if that's the caliber of people that are being hired, that's what the lawsuit claims. There is concern to put these people in a school system. That also said, in Parkland, a deputy chose not to go in and assist. So even a trained officer may have second thoughts if there's a gun-wielding suspect in a building.
And, I welcome thoughts from everyone here who's a parent. I'm a parent who has children, not in elementary school, but in the Duval County Public School System. We've heard a lot from parents, particularly mothers, about this issue. They're just concerned that these SSAs, as they're called, will not have adequate training to be armed around young children. At the same time, Tanika, Angela, the school board has said that these armed safety assistants have received hundreds of hours of training and that they feel comfortable about this.
Yeah. And for the record, I'm not a parent, but I can talk to you about some numbers from our reporting at Action News Jax. Our chief investigator, Jenna Bourne, reached out to JSO to find out, hey, you know, the complaint says that these school safety assistants are inadequately trained. Now, according to JSO, these school safety assistants are required to pass firearms training with 85% accuracy, and that's the same pass rate as law enforcement firearms instructors. But for patrol officers, they have to pass with 80%. So the argument could be that the school safety assistants have more training.
That's what the school board is saying. That's been their
stringent
response.
Requirement.
Yeah, they're saying that this is a more stringent requirement. At the same time, I'm just reading here from the complaint. They say Florida law generally prohibits individuals other than law enforcement officers from carrying guns in schools. SSAs are not law enforcement officers. They lack the power of arrest. They earn roughly half the salary of school resource officers and receive less than one-fifth of the training that school resource officers receive?
I'm not a parent either, Melissa, but what about that training when it comes to emotional, right? Mm-hmm. The emotional intelligence, looking for someone who maybe has a disability. How can you identify that? Will these safety officers, security officers, are they going to know how to do that? Like your trained law enforcement officers, like your school resource officers who know about de-escalation processes, right? Who know, okay, I can identify, Tanika, that this is what's happening. You and I going in, getting this training, may not be able to identify because we haven't had that type of training law enforcement goes through.
That's called critical incident training. And the police, the original lawsuit pointed out, get 44 hours of that so that they can get involved in active shooter incidents and training and understand what they're walking into, which apparently these assistants will not get. They will not have that knowledge of how to analyze what they're walking into.
Now, let's point out, too, that this whole program was set up in response to the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. 17 students and staff killed there. And the act the legislature passed, it requires districts to provide what's called a safe school officer at every school.
Yeah.
So that is how Duval is fulfilling this state mandate.
Yeah, it's an unfunded mandate. That's especially at the state legislature. Duval County is not cash rich. I mean, Warren Jones, the vice chair of the school board, was at the Duval delegation meeting Monday saying they need a $500,000 raise in the property tax so they have more money. They took the cheap solution here. They went with cheap employees. They couldn't afford the actual officers. And now they're reaping the benefits. People don't have confidence. The mayor's office, they claim to be working really well with the superintendent of schools. The sheriff, need to come up with a solution that actually fulfills legislative intent, because right now they have it and they're getting hammered.
All right, lots of calls coming in on this. Sandy is in Riverside. Hi, Sandy. Good morning.
Good morning. I just called in because I hate to see anyone, even a politician, badmouthed when they haven't earned it. Mike Hogan did send out Spanish language ballots ahead of time because I got one, and I don't speak Spanish, but I'm a registered voter, and when I got my sample ballot in the mail, it was Spanish and English.
Yeah.
The only place
he
didn't have Spanish language ballots was at the polls during early voting.
And that is where the complaint was filed. You're right, Sandy. And
oddly,
I appreciate that. Yes.
Let's be fair, even to a politician.
Yes, and oddly, they were posted at my polling precinct when I voted on Election Day. I don't know why they couldn't have gone out to the early precincts.
Thanks, Sandy. Thanks for that. Let's go to Matthew along I-95. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, go ahead.
So one of the things I wanted to make sure to comment, because I do work in education, and part of my role is to help implement this. We have different schools throughout the state. And part of the problem is, A, it was underfunded. B, it was haphazardly implemented. And C, it was you have three different ways to implement it. So you can have the guardian, you can have a school resource officer, or you can have an SSA. And part of that leaves it up to the counties to decide which way to implement this. And none of them have been funded properly. So, to your point, we're putting in people that don't have the proper resources, that haven't had the proper funding or training to properly carry out the duty that they've been charged with, which is a very serious duty. It goes back to similar to the implementation problem that you've discussed in other bills that have been passed and amendments, that there really hasn't been a lot of forethought into how to get this done. The bill actually called for a creation of an agency in the Department of Education that already existed, for example. So there wasn't a lot of forethought. It wasn't a lot of real, it was a real, really reactionary type of plan that was put together, but there wasn't a lot of scope. If there was a time for a bill to be implemented with some patience, this would have been
this
the one.
This would have been the one, you think.
Through the process.
Thank you, Matthew. Thank you for that. And this lawsuit is basically seeking to forestall, to stop these SSAs from ever walking school campuses with weapons.
Yeah, I mean, and the legislators I've talked to have said there's going to be some tweaks to the Parkland bill in this session. They know it's not perfect legislation. A lot of the focus was on the raising of the gun purchase rate to 20, 21. That was a big discussion point, and the school hardening measure, what it was actually about, kind of got elided. I think they're going to come back to that, take a second
we will
third
have
look.
To see, and I'm sure that will happen in the spring. In the meantime, what a busy week and what a great panel. Thank you all four of you so much for joining us with your insights into all of the news of the week. A.G. Gankarski, Dan Scanlon, Tanika Hughes, and Angela Spears. Thanks for being here. Stay dry as you head out the door and have a great weekend.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
And still ahead, a live in-studio performance from members of the critically acclaimed Soweto Gospel Choir. That's next. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9.
Mayo Clinic, where medical experts work together across specialties to improve diagnosis and treatment for patients with the most complex conditions. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. This holiday season, let's make sure that our presents for the kids we love aren't headed to the island of misfit toys.
More at terrellhogan.com.
In the new movie Mary Poppins Returns, Lin-Manuel Miranda plays Jack, a lamplighter.
He sees the light in any situation. He looks for the bright side, the hope, even in a dark time or in a dark place.
It's a far cry from the role of Alexander Hamilton that made Miranda a household name. That plus The Week in Politics, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we field a question from a curious second grader about her unfortunate encounter with a caterpillar.
Is it okay if you guys can study about the ass caterpillar? Well, the thing is, I got stung. It itches a lot. Are there other caterpillars that sting?
It's All Things Caterpillar on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, that escalated quickly.
None of us have
you
said.
You want to know something?
You've said
okay,
it.
Okay, you want to put that
you've
on my...
You've said it.
I'll take it.
Help wanted. The White House needs a chief of staff. Also, Trump's personal attorney gets prison time for covering up his client's dirty deeds. And YouTube's 2018 look back gets a record-breaking thumbs down. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. It's a special treat as the Beaches Fine Arts Series presents the two-time Grammy Award-winning Soweto Gospel Choir in a free concert this weekend. They are South Africa's quintessential musical ensemble, and they are bringing a celebration of the great freedom fighter and icon of reconciliation, Nelson Mandela, here to the First Coast. This is such a special event. We're pleased to welcome two of the performers from the Soweto Gospel Choir, Shimmy Jane and Milton Natklus, here to the studio, along with Kathy Wallace of Beaches Fine Arts Series. Good to see all of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us. Money.
Thank you for being here. Guys, the music is so beautiful. Tell us about the concert, a tribute to Nelson Mandela. This is a celebration of the anniversary of his 100th birthday. What can we expect?
It's a tribute to the great icon. It's a tribute to the father of the nation, the father of African continent, Rholihlahla Nelson Mandela. We will be taking our audience through a journey where South Africa, when South Africa was oppressed, and we will be also taking our audiences through what Mandela worked on and what Mandela stood for and what Mandela did when he came back from the 27 years that he spent in prison. and how Mandela has instilled the message of encouraging the nation to forgive but not to forget.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Freedom Medley, can you tell us a little bit about that? That's a big part of the performance, isn't it?
Absolutely, ma'am. The Freedom Medley is a very fundamental song because it really means a lot to us, as Shimi has mentioned. It goes a long way from 1948 to 1994. 1948, when the apartheid regime started in South Africa, we went through a lot of black people. But these songs are the songs that kept up our hopes, and they gave us faith, and they gave us, you know, something that will definitely stick into our hearts that it's going to be okay. And then 94, mm-hmm. that's when we actually liberated as a country, mainly because of Nelson Mandela. So as Shimi has mentioned, Nelson Mandela is an icon. I mean, he spent 27 years so that we can be liberated as a country. It's not everyone that can do that. So we are saluting him because of his work. So these songs mean a lot to us.
And they mean a lot to the entire world. Yes. This is a rare opportunity to see an internationally acclaimed ensemble, Kathy Wallace, Beaches Fine Arts Series. This is coming up this weekend, and it's free.
That's right. All of our concerts are free to the public. This one begins at 4 p.m. on Sunday afternoon. The doors open at 3:15 p.m., and there will be a crowd. So get there early, and we hope to see everyone there.
Again,
there's a reception that follows, by the way, and you can meet the artists at the reception.
Yeah, so what a special holiday treat. It's the Soweto Gospel Choir, presented by Beaches Fine Arts Series, Sunday at St. Paul's by the Sea Episcopal Church in Jack's Beach. It's free. First come, first serve seating. Guys, I know you're going to have standing room only. So thanks so much for stopping by and sharing a little bit about your artistry with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. Beachesfinearts.org for information. Yeah. It's a free performance. We're going to close with some more of the Soweto Gospel Choir. Just incredible music, incredible artistry. Enjoy the music. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back on Monday. Stay dry out there, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.